Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Thanks, as always, for joining us here and for the past, whatever it is, 12 years. Our guest today is Andrew Kaufman, author of The Gambler Wife, a true story of love, risk, and the woman who saved Dostoevsky, published by Riverhead and released this August. Andrew's previous works include Give War and Peace a Chance, Tolstoyan Wisdom for Troubled Times, and Understanding Tolstoy. He's also the co-author of Russian for Dummies. His work has been featured on Today, NPR, PBS, and in the Washington Post, amongst others. He's a Russian literature expert for Oprah's Book Club and founded Books Behind Bars, which is a great organization introducing incarcerated kids to the writings of Dostoevsky and other authors. The Gambler's Wife tells us the story of Anna Snitnikha, a young stenographer who on her first job finds herself rushing along with Fyodor Dostoevsky to complete a book that was to be published under a deadline that if not met might have ruined the career of one of the world's most famous authors. In the midst of the serialization at the same time of Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky was under intense pressure to complete a contractual obligation to write a novel in less than a month, a novel that would be The Gambler, the story of a man not unlike Dostoevsky, a man that Anna would take as her husband and, I don't know, shepherd through a life of uncertainty, epilepsy, misfortune, and compulsive gambling. And so, as a new woman of independence in Russia, becoming one of the world's first female publishers, and without her, we probably wouldn't have The Brothers Karamazov and perhaps other masterpieces. And Mr. Kaufman has captured the essence of this woman's life and why and how she chose to live that life, not unlike one of the protagonists of Dostoevsky's novels in terms of heartbreak and at times agony, dealing with a man who was a genius, but a pain in the ass, to say the least. So welcome, Andrew. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I love that introduction. Good to be here.
Hey, so I guess the first question that comes to mind is, why the hell did she do it?
Why did she do it? Well, I answer that question over the course of 300 pages in the book, so I'll try to answer very succinctly here. So part of what's interesting about her story is that she did start off as a young feminist. She was a proud member of the Russian feminist movement in the 1860s. She called herself, quote, an emancipated girl of the 60s. That's what the feminists called themselves. And they did use the word girl. I don't know, but they called themselves emancipated girls of the 1860s. And so this was her first job as a stenographer. And working for Dostoevsky was sort of her way to a path of independence. She was excited that she got this job. But it's important to understand part of her motivation comes from the fact that Anna actually grew up with Dostoevsky. She met him on the page before she met him in life. When she was a teenager, he was one of her favorite writers. And her father used to subscribe to the journal that Dostoevsky co-wrote or co-created with his brother. And Anna would steal off into the garden and lose herself in the pages of, you know, her favorite works by Dostoevsky, which at that time were Notes from the House of the Dead, semi-autobiographical prison memoir, and The Humiliated, Insulted and Injured, as it's called. And so she had an enormous love of and respect for Dostoevsky. And so it's important to keep that in mind that and she was more than just a fangirl. I mean, she had a literary sensibility. She was very intelligent, very educated, you know, one of the best students in her class. And so when she was 20 and she had an opportunity to work for this man whose writing she, you know, admired deeply, not only was that for her the beginning of, you know, her finding a professional path for herself that was satisfying she as a stenographer initially, but that it was a path that would be very meaningful. So she was helping a writer that she admired. And so her, this partnership with Dostoevsky over time would in fact afford Anna the opportunity to have a meaningful career, a satisfying career as an entrepreneur, as a publisher, and many other things, but also a career with meaning that, you know, where she was helping the dissemination of this great writer that she admired. But the last thing I'll say is she loved him. And ultimately that is what kept them together during the very dark times in their relationship. She loved this man with all of his many, many faults and foibles. And it is true that in the 21st century, there would be many women, or even the 20th century, many women who would not have stayed in a marriage like this. But she stayed for a variety of reasons, some of which I mentioned. The other reason I will say is divorce was much harder back then. She contemplated divorce more than once in some of the just the harrowing moments in their relationship when she was being exposed to the extent of his gambling addiction, where it was ruining them. They didn't have three meals a day. And she ultimately, that is one very practical reason that, you know, who knows, had she lived in a different time, she may have decided in one of those moments that divorce was the right option. But it was much more difficult for women at that time.
You know, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole with regard to Dostoevsky himself, because we want to talk about Anna. But, you know, I just read that article in The Atlantic that just came out about why he wrote
Crime and Punishment.
Crime and Punishment. I was thinking of War and Peace for some reason. Why he wrote Crime and Punishment. So I guess we have to go back a little bit to the situation where, and I can't even imagine, I guess only that one story by Sartre about feeling like you're living the last 5 minutes of your life. So you know a lot better than me. Maybe you could just, you know, I don't want to do that too much, but at least you can give us a little bit of background, because otherwise people wouldn't understand.
Well, so I assume what you're referring to is where Dostoevsky was in his life, in his career, when he met Anna.
Yeah.
And yes, that is important, because to kind of understand not only where he was, but had Anna not shown up when she did, we may not have Dostoevsky. He had been in prison. So seven years earlier, he had returned to Petersburg, Russia, after a four-year prison sentence for his previous involvement in revolutionary activity. He belonged to what was called the Petrushevsky Circle, and they were trying to reform, and some extreme groups of sects of that society were trying to overthrow the government. Dostoevsky was a part of that in his youth. He was sentenced to, initially he was sentenced to execution, and he was about to be executed. And at the last minute, the Tsar, you know, it was a mock execution. The Tsar was just trying to strike fear in these young men, not actually kill them. But in lieu of that execution, he was sentenced to Siberian prison for 4 years, and then another 4 years of mandatory military service. Many of the other young men, and they were all young men who belonged to this Petrushevsky circle, went literally mad after that ordeal of mock execution. And so, and for Dostoevsky, that would be a lens through which he would see so much of the world from that point on, a very apocalyptic view of things, a recognition that life is contingent, can be snuffed out in an instant. And so much of his philosophy in his later novels stems from that existential sense of terror. Well, so you can imagine, he spends 8 years in Siberian prison. He comes back. He's a forgotten man. No one remembers Dostoevsky because he hadn't produced anything really significant prior to his departure. And so he starts to reestablish himself. And he does start to get some traction with this journal that he publishes with his brother, with a couple of his early works, The Insulted and Injured, which is this melodramatic novel about a struggling artist and a poor orphan girl. Also his semi-fictionalized prison memoir, Notes from the House of the Dead. So these are works that he started to publish afterwards. And even though these were important works, they weren't great works. So Dostoevsky, and on top of this, so Dostoevsky is really trying to establish himself as, you know, one in the front ranks of Russian literature. And he hadn't done so yet. On top of this, he had a terrible gambling addiction. He was traveling to Europe every so often to meet up with his, also he had a lover, a secret lover that he was seeing, you know, on the side, his wife, the wife that he had married after prison was dying. And so his life was very much in shambles personally. His wife ended up dying. He made an attempt to propose to another woman named Anna. She rejected him in a very dramatic, darkly comedic story about how he proposed, etc. So he was longing for love. He was longing for companionship. He was trying to really let people see that he was not just an important writer, but a great writer. And this, and he had epilepsy. And so his life was really in shambles in so many ways. And one of the things that was the straw that almost broke the camel's back is that because he was in debt and he had to get to Europe to gamble, he signed a terrible publishing agreement with a publisher that landed him in a really in a pickle where he had to produce, ultimately he had to produce a new novel, as you mentioned in the introduction, by November 1st, 1866. If he failed to do so, he would lose the copyrights on everything he wrote for the next 9 years. And so this is the context in which Anna Snitkina comes into his life, a man who is ill, who is forlorn, who is depressed, who is unlucky at cards, unlucky at love, and had not yet established himself as a great Russian writer, which means if Anna had not shown up when she did, who knows what might have happened. Dostoevsky might have ended up like Edgar Allan Poe and died somewhere in a ditch, not to be dramatic, but if you read the book, you will see that that is not an exaggeration given where he was in his life.
Yeah, they seemed to, it didn't really change his entire life. He was always on the very edge of, you know, it's like, I can't believe they were able to make it each episode, whether it's in Wiesbaden or wherever it is. But, oh, in any event, why don't you, because I only have a galley, why don't you show the cover of the book so people can, it's, you know, it'll be on the, it's on the front table in my bookstore, but I don't have it here now.
I got my notes here too.
So yeah, that's a picture of her in one of the few, and that's an excellent font. And it's a really good color too, because as I say in all my interviews, being a bookseller for so many years, everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but everybody who comes into my bookstore does exactly that. And then, you know, since you got the book there, talk a little bit about the dedication, which is kind of humorous and poignant at the same time.
So it's the book is, the dedication is written for Corinne, my gambler wife, and my father, the original gambler. And if you read the acknowledgments in the back, you'll understand better what these two, why I've dedicated to these two people. But my wife, you know, I am a writer, and thank God I have never experienced anything even bordering on, you know, Dostoevsky's troubles that he had when he met Anna, and even after that. But still, I do appreciate as a writer the sacrifices that a spouse makes and my wife has made for me to make sure, you know, that I can do what I love. And, you know, and we both work full time, you know, we're both incredibly busy. But it was during the writing of this book that I really started to appreciate just how important those people are in your life, the people that are closest to you. In my case, my wife, who, you know, afforded me that opportunity and has supported me and been a staunch advocate of me. And she herself is very much like Anna in the sense that she is entrepreneurial, she's creative, she's ambitious, she's smart. And so my wife is, Corinne is her name, is a woman that Anna would have admired and would have related to. You know, both are very progressive, forward-thinking, driven, ambitious, but both are also very traditional in the sense, you know, Anna believed in a traditional marriage and the importance of that vow and that dedication in a marriage. And so that's why I've studied. What?
And my dad.
So I don't want people to think that my dad was a gambler. He was not. He's not a gambler like Dostoevsky. My dad was an entrepreneur and a successful business person who understood the value of risk taking, who always encouraged me to take risks, to not play it too safe, because he didn't want me to be 70 years old and look back on my life and, you know, and say, well, I played it safe, but I didn't really take the chances and that I wanted to. My father also passed away during the writing of this book, which is another reason that it was important to dedicate it to him. And he was a huge supporter of mine as a writer, as a creative risk taker, you know, and as a son.
So as long as you have the book in hand, we were talking about reading a small passage from it. And the one you said you were going to read is great for me because it kind of turned the book on its head for me because I'm thinking, anyway, you tell a little bit about it and you can read the passage.
So, and I think this passage will also help begin to make sense of why it's called The Gambler Wife. So Anna and Dostoevsky, the first several months of, you know, they got married. So what happened, she showed up in his life. She was a stenographer. They finished the novel, The Gambler. Thank God. She saved his career. They fall in love. They get married. They have problems start right away with Anna's in-laws who hate her. Dostoevsky's in-laws don't like her because she's an intrusion, because for years they had been taking advantage of Dostoevsky financially because he was very pliant, very gullible, and very generous. And so they recognize Anna as someone that stood between his pocketbook and them. And so Anna realized they had to get out of town, otherwise their marriage was not going to stay afloat. So she pawns her dowry. She pawns her dowry to raise enough money for them to get to Europe, to get out of town, to get to Europe, to go on a honeymoon. And things only get tougher from there. And so what she discovers when they're in Europe is that this man who wrote the novel, the novella, The Gambler, that she helped transcribe, that it was based on much more autobiographical of a work than she even suspected. She realized that Dostoevsky had a gambling addiction. He took a trip a couple of weeks into their honeymoon to Bad Homburg, and he sends her letters, these really desperate, pathetic letters, begging her for, you know, for more money and asking for her forgiveness. And she would send him more and he would blow that money too. And then he finally returns, and then they go to Baden-Baden. And now Anna is witnessing his gambling with her own eyes, because she's going to the casino with him, trying to lure him away from the roulette tables, she would feign a headache or come up with these stories that would, you know, that some guy was pestering her in the other room, and would Dostoevsky please come with her? She was doing what she could to lure him away. And then when that didn't work, she was studying the other gamblers and then trying to advise Dostoevsky on how he should gamble. And that didn't work. Nothing worked. And she was, and they didn't have three meals a day. He was pawning her wedding dress, her wedding ring, her brooch. She had hit rock bottom. And she wrote in her diary, and that was one of the moments that she was thinking about divorcing him. And she wrote in her diary, she said, "If he thinks I'm his slave, here to obey his every whim, well, it is time for him to abandon that delusion of his." And one of the ways she helped him do that is by doing something that he forbade her to do. He never wanted her to go to the casino alone. She always had to go with him. But not only did she go to the casino alone, she actually took some of their last money and gambled. And so there's a chapter in the book called The Gambler Wife, where we see Anna as a gambler. And I'll just read a couple of lines from the last part of this scene of Anna at the roulette table. So she won and she lost and she won and she lost. When she finally found the presence of mind to count up her coins, she discovered that she was up by $19 or $270. It was money the Dostoevskys could have used, certainly. Along with the money from her mother, it would have been enough to pay off many of their most pressing debts, not least their back rent. "I'd like Fady to come in now so that I could show him," she thought with defiance as she placed another bet. Sure enough, at that very instant, there he was, standing in the doorway. "I could have easily crept out without his seeing me." She's writing all this in her diary. "I could have easily crept out without his seeing me, but was horrified at the whiteness of his face. A dead giveaway that he just suffered another loss." At the sight of him, her defiance gave way to concern, and she rushed up to him without even noticing that she'd lost her latest bet. When Dostoevsky saw her, he was furious that she would come alone at her age, in her condition, to such a place. She was pregnant. He grabbed her hand now to escort her right out of the casino, lecturing her sternly on how she should have quit the table immediately after winning, or she was bound to lose everything she'd won. "I've noticed things like that happen to you too," she responded bitterly, her defiance returning. "Besides," she added, "it wasn't such a tragedy losing a few 5 golden pieces, seeing as I had just had some money sent from Petersburg." Unlike her husband, she had managed to leave the tables with only $1 less than she'd come with. And I just want to say, by way of follow-up, I want to say, he started teasing her when they got back home. And for the next several days, he would tease her and he would say, "Boy, you're lucky. You know, my poor lost wife, you're lucky that I came just in the nick of time and saved you." And he started calling her "my little gambler wife." "Boy, you're lucky, my gambler wife, my little gambler wife, that I saved you just in the nick of time." And that phrase, "gambler wife," just stuck out to me. And what I realized over the course of writing this book is Dostoevsky was saying that condescendingly, but in fact, Anna was a gambler wife in every sense, in many more senses than even Dostoevsky could have appreciated at that point in their relationship when he made that snide remark. And so that is why the book's title, after several years of working on it, changed from "The Gambler's Wife" to "The Gambler Wife."
Here's a question that I have. How do you pawn your underwear? I mean, seriously, I doubt that there's much of a market for either of ours, but, and then what do you do after you pawn it?
Well, so at that time, apparently, and this was not, that wasn't the only time that they pawned someone's underwear in this marriage. When they were in Geneva, a couple of years, actually a little after that, they were had hit another low point. And Dostoevsky said if he hadn't have pawned his underwear, they would have died. I don't know. I've never been in pawn shops. I did live in Vegas for a while, so I was very familiar with pawn shops. But I don't know what kinds of things you can pawn. But all I know is that they were so hard up that even 50 cents or a dollar for a piece of underwear was enough to get them by for a half a day.
That's the other thing is that, and all the reviews, including the New York Times review, talk about is that they were always in such dire straits, and it didn't make any sense to me how, you know, first of all, they're on essentially a four-year honeymoon, and you know, you have a stepson that precludes trips to Europe, and they get around that and all that. But how can you live if you're consistently, essentially, completely broke? And then asking for money from everywhere, but always losing it and always having nothing. How did they basically even eat or have a place to stay? That was difficult for me to comprehend.
So at the last minute, money always magically appeared. Either Anna's mother would send money from Petersburg. One of Dostoevsky's friends would wire money, or it wasn't called wiring back then. They had at the post office, I don't know what it was called, but they would basically send Dostoevsky money. So there isn't a letter that Dostoevsky wrote that doesn't have some reference to, you know, financial need, and at least during this period and earlier in his life. Later on, Anna kind of writes this ship, and all of that will change because of her wise stewardship. But so money will appear, and then he would magically win at roulette. And so they would have, you know, they would have a surplus for a period of time. Of course, he would blow most of it the very next day. And so I don't know. And they also could live on credit in hotels. That was very common back then, that you could, you know, stay, you know, for a period of time without paying. And then as soon as he, you know, won something or had money sent, then they could pay their back rent. But it is what you would call an almost hand-to-mouth existence. They were almost homeless. They were on the verge of that every moment. And so I don't know how they did it psychologically, emotionally. But yeah, it was very dicey for periods of time, but it would ebb and flow. You know, there'd be periods, you know, a week or weeks at a time where they were either flush with cash for them, or at least had enough to get by. And then, you know, it would disappear and they'd be back in the same boat.
Here's a personal aside. I knew just enough at the time that when I was practicing law, I had a deposition in Wiesbaden. And because of what I knew, I put on my best suit and carried a very thin umbrella like a cane and went to the casino and played roulette. And I actually hit the number, and then you always leave a chip on the same number you hit. And I actually hit it a second time. And then again, as we'll talk later, you know, I'm Jewish. There's all these Germans around me. From time to time, they would apologize to me. I didn't know how they knew, but they would apologize to me for what had happened. I said, okay, it's not necessary. But yeah, so I had that same experience at a table that was probably the same 100 years before. So that was
that casino that you played at was the very casino where Dostoevsky's gambling addiction was finally ended. And I described that scene in the book.
Yeah.
I was at that casino as well. I was at the casino in Baden-Baden and Bad Homburg. I visited all the casinos in Germany, and the one in Baden-Baden is still has been preserved to look much the way that it did in the 1800s at the time that Dostoevsky played. So what I was witnessing there was the actual room, you know, that looked very much like the actual room that Dostoevsky played in, that Anna played in. So I had a real sense of what that was like to be in that space.
And you do a really good job of describing it because, you know, they're beautiful, almost cathedral-like in terms of their luxuriousness and beautiful chandeliers and the gold and silver coins on the table. You really painted a really good picture. And that's the way I felt when I was actually there as well.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, so you can imagine how Dostoevsky must have felt going into these casinos, which were really catering towards wealthy people. And he was dirt poor, and he always felt out of place. He felt, and even in The Gambler, the novella that he wrote, his character who's based on him talks about, you know, two kinds of gamblers, the wealthy gamblers who, you know, who don't need the money and it's beneath them to have any emotion whatsoever. They can win hundreds of thousands or lose hundreds of thousands. But the way that you prove that you're wealthy and upper class is that you don't let that bother you. And then there's the riffraff, people like Dostoevsky, the plebeian gamblers, the ones who needed the money and for whom gambling was. And you see them around the tables like this, you know, they're not calm, they're agitated and intense. And that's what Dostoevsky was like when he was gambling, which is why he looked so out of place and felt so out of place in these elegant casinos.
And then he paints all these characters in all of his books in similar straits, like Raskolnikov. You know, they're always down to their last, you know, they're barely getting by. And then there's this interior monologue all the time, which is so pre-Joycean, you know, these interior monologues that hadn't really occurred before, and notes from the underground. And that's why, as you say, you know, it wasn't that it was reviled, but I don't think anyone got it, right?
No, they didn't. It was ahead of its time. But just imagine being a 20, 21, 22-year-old woman experiencing all of this. And that's what I try to communicate in that second part of my book called The Reckoning. The book is actually, the first section is called The Gamble. Of course, we don't know which gamble we're referring to here. There's been a lot of gambles taking place. Then The Reckoning, and then the payoff. And that middle part of the book, which describes at length those 4 years, that harrowing honeymoon that didn't have much honey in it. And that Anna, like, that she was by his side. She experienced all this. She stayed by his side. It's incredible. It's incredible. And Dostoevsky, Dostoevsky, even though he was an addict, he understood what gift Anna was giving to him. In fact, in one of his letters, you know, he compared her to Christ or someone that Christ would come for. He said, it's for those like you, you know, that Christ would come. And if my wife's, you know, if my wife said that to me, I would probably, you know, be floored. I wouldn't like know what to do with that. Or I think she was being ironic or cheeky. Well, Dostoevsky meant that. He understood, even though with all of his foibles and shortcomings and blind spots, he understood the gift of love and compassion that Anna was giving him, and she was treating him with dignity and not judging him for these terrible flaws, much the way that Sonia in Raskolnikov, in The Crime and Punishment, the young prostitute to whom the murderer Raskolnikov confesses his crime, she doesn't judge him. In fact, she begins to weep, understanding the depth of his pain. And so in some ways, you know, Dostoevsky understood what this kind of profound compassion looks like because he had at his side a living embodiment of that in Anna. And one of the points I make in the book is that this influenced him in ways that have not been acknowledged in the scholarship. Dostoevsky's profound interest in the theme of compassion and redemption and active love don't just come from his interest, you know, in Christian theology. It also comes from his personal experience of having a wife who embodied these qualities and stayed by his side during these four harrowing years in Europe. And so she influenced his writing in ways that really have not been appreciated, I think, until now.
It's funny that her life gives me a better appreciation of the semi-epilogue of Crime and Punishment, when Sonia essentially
follows him to Siberia.
Yeah, and turns his life around. And some critics find that somewhat, I guess, cloying, that that was added at the end and thought maybe it would be better if he just went on being the retrobate that he was. But this gave me a better understanding of that and his understanding of Christianity, which was a little, I don't know, over the top. Oh, which reminds me of what we're talking about before. I'm Jewish, you're Jewish, and he's this virulent anti-Semite. There's an episode where he is lost and ends up, harrowingly for him, in front of a synagogue because he was so anti-Semitic. And then in this day and age of cancel culture, one of the reviews, I think the Times, talks about how you refreshingly, I think that's the word they used, refreshingly delve into this without making any judgments. And but then they also say, you know, maybe today, soon now, maybe because of your book, people will say, you know, well, we shouldn't be reading him because he's such a horrible person. Talk a little bit about your own experience going back to the synagogue.
Well, so the synagogue that you're referring to, let me just tell a little bit about the story. So they had been in Europe for 4 years now. It's the spring of 1871. Anna is literally dying of homesickness. I mean, she's ill, and a lot of her illness is from this extended separation from her home. Dostoevsky's dying creatively. They have to get back to Russia. Plus, she's pregnant. She's 6 months pregnant. She's going to give birth. They cannot afford to stay in Europe. And the only source of income at that time was through Dostoevsky's writing, but his creativity had stalled. And so she does an amazing thing. She says, go to Wiesbaden, go gamble. They only had 300 thalers left. She gave them 100, go. Incredibly risky move. And I talk in the book about why she made such a decision. But her gamble in that moment paid off because he lost everything, as she knew he would. She sent him more money. But when he came back, he wrote up a storm and he was able to submit the next installment of The Possessed, get 1,000 rubles from the editor, and that afforded them the chance of getting back to Russia. But something else happened on that occasion. It would be the last time Dostoevsky would ever gamble. That was the end after all of those years of an addiction. Suddenly it ended. He never gambled again. And there's lots of possible explanations for it. But what happened was the moment is he ran out of the casino like a madman. Those are his words. And he ran to what he thought was a Russian Orthodox church to go confess. And what he realized when he was running is that what he thought was a Russian Orthodox church was a Jewish synagogue. And he stopped dead in his tracks. And for him, that was an omen that he had become so seduced by the greed that he always, you know, associated with European culture, that he was becoming like a Westerner, like a materialistic Westerner, of which for him the Jews were the embodiment. Materialistic, greedy, all of the typical anti-Semitic stereotypes, Dostoevsky subscribed to those. And that was part of the reason And that was assigned to him. And that was part of the reason. That wasn't at all the only reason he stopped gambling. But in that moment, it was symbolic for him. Well, I went to that. I went to Wiesbaden. I visited the casino. And I went to look for the synagogue that Dostoevsky ran to. As it turns out, it had been bombed during World War II. But in its place, there was a memorial to the Jews who had perished in Auschwitz, the Jews of Wiesbaden. And so now here I am researching a book about Anna Dostoevsky, kind of for this scene, you know, where Dostoevsky's anti-Semitic impulses reveal themselves. I'm standing on the site of what was the synagogue and looking at a memorial to the victims of Auschwitz as a Jew. And so I had a lot of, you know, very mixed feelings going on in my mind, because ultimately Dostoevsky's anti-Semitism would win the day, right? I mean, Hitler would eventually come to power. The Jews would be sent to their deaths. So I am writing about a writer who fueled the very anti-Semitism which caused this memorial to need to be there in the first place. And so I can't say I've reconciled that. It was a very emotionally difficult moment for me. But as a teacher, as a professor, as a reader, the question I always have to ask myself is, do I not read Dostoevsky then? Do I choose to not read him at all because of these, you know, really noxious, this really noxious side of his personality? And obviously the choice I made is that I am going to read him. But I think it is possible, and for me, this is my solution. I think everyone has to make their own solution. It is possible to love him and hate him at the same time. It is possible for me to separate where his genius lies, what contributions his art can make to my life and the world, and even some of his genius lies in the very things that are noxious about him. It's possible to appreciate that, but also not to shy away from the reality that he was an anti-Semite and that he disseminated anti-Semitic motifs and ideas which were noxious in his writing and in his art. But both of those can coexist at the same time.
It's interesting because, like, in the Greek sense, that would be kind of like your apologetic response with regard to Dostoevsky, which I think is the appropriate response today, should be the appropriate response, because in the cancel culture, we're losing genius, we're losing beautiful works because we can't separate the writer from his own personal existence. But I tend to go astray, and I am now. So let's bring it back to the third part of the book, because the redemption aspect of it, what's fascinating to me, and again in the reviews, is that here's a woman who through these trials and tribulations then becomes this groundbreaking person who becomes a publisher. And again, without that, we might not have, we wouldn't have Brothers Karamazov.
So Anna had all of those qualities in her before she met Dostoevsky. She was a risk taker. She had chutzpah, courage. She was ambitious. She was intelligent. But so she was kind of the makings of an entrepreneur were already there. But these four harrowing years, or five, the first 5 years of her marriage with Dostoevsky, really shaped her in profound ways. And she would channel all of the lessons, the life lessons that she would learn during that time into what would become an incredibly challenging, risky career as Russia's first female publisher. And that's important to emphasize that. All of her family and friends said, don't do this. Don't take any chances. No woman has successfully run her own publishing business, a cutthroat business. Don't do it. Well, Anna listened to them, but then she did her own research. She went around to the bookstores. She would pose, you know, she would pretend that she's an innocent, you know, customer, and she would ply the bookstore owner with questions about, you know, how much, where they get their supplies from and how much discount they get. She was doing her reconnaissance work. And at the end of that, she concluded that whatever the risks, they were worth taking. And in 1873, she opened their publishing imprint to bring out The Possessed. And Dostoevsky, from that single novel, would earn, in today's money, $50,000, which is more than he earned from any of his works, certainly from any advance up to that point. So she became very quickly a successful publisher, bringing out editions of all of his works, Later on, she would become the creator of Russia's first book distribution businesses. It started off bringing out works of Dostoevsky, and then she would sell works by other writers. And so by the time of Dostoevsky's death, Anna had managed to dig them out of debt and even give them a little bit of cash. And Dostoevsky, on his deathbed, felt terrible that he was leaving her with nothing. The fact is, she was left with something largely due to her own efforts. And then after he died, that's when she really took off as a publisher. She published 7 editions of his complete collected works over the next 20 years. Again, her family and friends said, don't do this. It's too risky. Never been done before. Just take your pension and take the small. And someone had offered her some money for the rights to all of Dostoevsky's works. And she said, no, it is my moral duty to publish the works of my husband. And so she could have lived comfortably, but she took the risk and it paid off, because over the next 25, 30 years, she would publish these 7 editions and they would bring in what in today's money is the equivalent of $5 million. So she was a very successful entrepreneur, and she used that money to support libraries and museums. She founded Russia's first literary museum, and she opened the first parish school for peasant children in the provinces, which graduated 1,000 peasant girls who might otherwise never have had an opportunity for an education. So that's just an example of that just kind of gives you a sense of the full journey that she took and how she channeled all of these talents and skills of hers into a successful career as a publisher, but also as a philanthropist.
And also, I was, you know, the idea that Tolstoy's wife consults with her, which is also something fascinating.
She became Anna was a powerhouse. In today's term, she would be called a badass. She was a badass, and people had heard of her and heard of her successes, including the wife of Leo Tolstoy, who approached Anna and asked Anna for advice on how she could start a publishing firm for her husband, like the one that Anna started for Dostoevsky. And Anna was very proud of the fact that Sofia Tolstaya, Tolstoy's wife, listened to her, took her advice, and then created a successful publishing firm of her own. And Sonia Tolstaya would return frequently over the next several years and ask Anna for ongoing business advice.
Well, in conclusion, let's go back to the very beginning, because obviously in the introduction, when I talk about your interests and the works that you've written, what brought you to the point where you said, this is something that I think I need to put out there. This is a story that hasn't been told and I want to tell it.
So I'm glad you asked that question, because I think my journey to this book is important. So I was always a Tolstoy guy for years. I wrote 2 books on Tolstoy. My last one in 2014 called Give War and Peace a Chance, Tolstoy and Wisdom for Troubled Times. But it wasn't until I started teaching in a prison. I have a program at UVA where I take my undergraduates to a juvenile correctional center and now an adult prison, and they discuss classics of Russian literature with incarcerated populations. It wasn't until I started working in prison that I started to appreciate the genius of Dostoevsky, and my interest shifted from Tolstoy to Dostoevsky, because Dostoevsky was himself incarcerated. A lot of the themes in his works really resonate with this group. So, you know, being a scholar, I started digging into the research on Dostoevsky. I started reading the biographies about him, and I kept coming across this name, Anna Dostoevsky, his second wife. And it was clear, even from the biographies, that she was important. But it wasn't until I started digging into her memoirs and her secret diary and her archival material that I came to appreciate she wasn't just important in his life. She made a definitive difference. She saved him in every sense. And were it not for her, I do not think we would have the Brothers Karamazov or The Idiot or The Possessed or any of the great works that Dostoevsky wrote after she came into his life. And so it was important to me that people knew this, that they knew this story. And even as my research went even deeper, I started to realize it's not just what she did for Dostoevsky, it's what she did for literary history. It's what she did in her own right as a successful entrepreneur and publisher and philanthropist. She was an extraordinary woman. And so I just naturally became very interested in her story. And And she became the focus of my book. It changed, the title changed from The Gambler's Wife, as I said, to The Gambler Wife. And it was very important for me for people to appreciate this woman whose story has never been told before in English and only twice in Russian, and to appreciate not just what she meant to Dostoevsky, but who she was in her own right, and her complexity and her subtlety and the risks that she took and the decisions that she made. Her story had to be told. And so that is ultimately why I wrote this book, and I loved every minute of it.
And as a bookseller, those are the books that I and my staff are going to tell somebody, you have to read this, because it's the stories that haven't been told. That, you know, I could show them a book about the Titanic. There literally are 150 of them, I think. But there aren't, this isn't there. And people who know Dostoevsky or even don't, this is a story that should be told. And I thank you, and I'm sure many people will thank you and appreciate the fact that you took this Herculean effort to talk about someone who otherwise might not be known by most Americans. So thanks, Andrew, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. And I also want to put a plug out for Wellington Square Bookshop. If you are interested in buying the book, please buy it from Wellington Square Bookshop. We want to support our indies. So I really do appreciate you giving me the platform today to talk about my book.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.